Let's sit. No more. Let's learn. Let's evolve. Let's talk. Today is Let's Talk Business with your host, Jai Lawton.
That's right, you're tuned into Let's Talk Business. My name is Jai Lawton, a Bidjara man from central West Queensland, and your host for the weekly Let's Talk Business series. Before we start, I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land we broadcast here in the West End of Brisbane and all across the country, wherever you are listening. I would like to acknowledge the unceded sovereignty of all First Nations people across the many nations in this continent and acknowledge all elders, past and present. Today we are speaking to Professor Greg Phillips, the founder and CEO of Abstar Consulting. Greg is a leading changemaker, thought leader, medical anthropologist and longtime friend of Let's Talk of many years. We are lucky enough to have Greg join us on today's program. Hello and welcome to the program, Greg.
G'day, brother. How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. Can we start with your mob and your country?
Sure. I'm Wanyi on my grandmother's side from north of Mount Isa and Jim Kimberley's on grandfather's side. And I'm coming to you today from Boonwurrung country down here in Naam in Melbourne. But, sending all my love to all the mob back at home.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. And Greg, you've worked with Indigenous people globally for the last 25 years in the business of cultural safety, transformational learning and leadership. Can you tell us about this journey to now and where did this all start for you?
Big question, but short version is when my grandmother was telling me stories of the country when I was about 6 years old and telling me about how they survived, how she saw Halley's Comet back in 1910, and then again in 1986. So those stories, I didn't know it when I was a young kid, but they helped solidify my knowing of who I am and where I come from. So that's where it started. And then I was lucky to have good Aboriginal education support workers at primary, high school and university. Grew up in Mount Isa. I knew I had to get out of the small town mentality to learn something new.
Mm.
So I went to Brisbane and, was lucky to have Auntie Lilla and Auntie Mary Graham and lots of people there support us in the Aboriginal support unit. And it just sort of grew from there and then starting to work with Indigenous mobs overseas and back home here, land councils, education work, youth work and healing work. And I did that all through my teens and 20s and then went and studied this thing called medical anthropology that I didn't even know what it was. And I didn't really know how to describe myself, but it's medical anthropology is just a white man name for different cultures and groups in society have different beliefs about healing and medicine and sickness and illness. And if you don't understand that group's cultural values and where they come from, then you don't know whether or not they're going to accept a certain health program or approach. And so I learned the science of all of that. How do you make sure that cultural values are embedded in healthcare? And not only health, but in education and justice and all sorts of areas, making sure that programs come from an Aboriginal point of view in terms of reference rather than just what's served up to us from government departments.
And the stewardship of Auntie Lilla Watson and Auntie Mary Graham, I can, very much still a big part of this organisation here. And, their knowledge is, I always love sitting down with them too. And just their politics, their philosophies on all things is, I feel like I learn a lot through them.
Mm. Well, I think that's the point. Most of our mobs haven't had the opportunity, even if we grew up in strong black families and strong community, we haven't had enough opportunities to sit down with our mob and talk about the bigger picture.
Mm.
How do we make sense of this crazy colonised world we live in? Who were we before 1770? Who are we now?
Mm.
And a lot of our mob focus on culture, like the external, and that's important, the external practice of language or dance or song, or art and reviving those practices. And that's very, very important that we do that. But what they teach me and many other elders is that it's not just that physical expression of dance or music or song. It's the cultural and spiritual values underneath it that go with it.
Mm.
See?
Mm.
So it sort of is less important if you actually know your songs and stories and dance. It's very good that we learn them, continue to learn them. But it's more important that we understand the values underneath. why, and what's that bigger picture, and how does it all fit in? And this is a lifelong journey. We can only learn these things over life. And so what we have to do in community is set up the opportunities for not only young people, but all of us to keep learning and relearning these deeper things.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm grateful to them for putting me on that journey.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've seen the evolution of, you know, this whole thing of cultural awareness to now the term cultural safety. And I have first heard that term through your work and the work we've done, you know, many years back now in youth justice here in Queensland. So can you explain to the listeners, like, what is cultural safety?
Well, I don't really care what Aboriginal people call it. I spent 12 months of my PhD sitting down and trawling through every document I could find of what blackfellas had written, not the whitefellas, but what we write and think and how we talk in conferences and yarnings and whatever. And I trawled through all of that and realised that even amongst us blackfellas, we use three different words or terminology to mean the same thing sometimes. Or sometimes we use the same word, how I use cultural safety might be different to other Aboriginal people. So I'm sort of not even really concerned about the term itself, the word, but I am very concerned about what you mean by it. So we, all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, have good ways, thought that if we teach white people our cultures, and every community is different, if we teach them our cultures and knowledges, that somehow they will magically become better health professionals and lawyers and policymakers and, you know, teachers just from learning our culture. Now, they should learn a bit about our culture. That is true. But the problem is they're not learning about their own culture of racism, of whiteness, of their colonial thinking. So cultural safety, I settled on that one because the Maori nurses first came up with the word, but it's a bit different in Australia. It's our own version of cultural safety. And it basically means that you have to train your workforce, all right, all the teachers in a school, let's say, or all the health workers in a hospital, that's fine. All white fellas should know a little bit about our culture, no worries. But that alone is not going to improve services or close the gap or decolonise systems. That's only half the story. The skills and competencies of the workforce. The other half of the story is the policies, procedures, workplace culture, funding allocations, decision making. That's where the rubber hits the road. So the way I use cultural safety, it refers to both of those things. The skills and capabilities and knowledge of the workforce, of the workers, but also the ability of the system around them and the policies to agree that they need to change their shit and do it. So cultural safety is about individual and institutional, and it's about white people taking responsibility for their racism, intended or unintended. When so cultural safety is not culture. That's only one small element of it. Cultural safety is institutional reform.
And in your work, Greg, like when you see institutional reform, you know, and we talk about systems change, like how do we know when we're on the right track, or how do we know when that penny drops and you can see an organisation that is starting to understand it and get it?
Well, there are at least four parts to that story. And some, you know, as you know, some mobs will think, all right, we've got to train everyone in that organisation and keep that training going and whatever. And that's good, that's deadly. But even if you did only that one part of it, you've got to make sure you're training on the right thing. Don't teach them our culture. They don't deserve to know our culture until they deal with their own culture of racism and grief and all their crying and coming to terms with their own colonial roots. That is the essential first step for them to become ready and willing learners of our culture. So we sometimes give them too much of our culture and they're not ready for it or don't deserve it. We have to make sure they're ready first. That's only one element, the training. The second element is what's the strategic fix across the whole organisation? And a reconciliation action plan is not it. Again, it's an important, nice first step, nice pretty colours and pictures. They might hang the flag out the front. They might have barbecue during, you know, sausage sizzle during NAIDOC week. Good on them. They might even employ 2.3 Aborigines. You know, I'm being cheeky. But now that's all good, but that's not going to get them anywhere. That's only the first step. So what we do is we drill them a little bit, take them through their grief journey and say to them, well, I don't work with no organisation that's not serious. I say to them, if you want all that stuff, plenty of other consultants out there can write you a wrap. Go to them, Mom. Mm. But when you've done all of that and you realise it's not working or you're still not getting outcomes, and if, that's a big if you want to know why, then come back to us. Mm. And what we do is gently but very firm but fair, take them through that learning and unlearning transformational journey till they get that light bulb moment. We slap them around the head a bit when they need it, good ways.
Yep.
And we go gentle with them, good ways, when we know that they're serious. So that's why we say we specialise in the art and science of decolonisation. Reconciliation not going to get us nowhere. It's too polite. It's all white fellas making white people feel nice about dots and paintings. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't do it, but that's only one part of change. And so what we do is map out a sensible organisational reform piece for them over however long time and then step them through that journey. But you asked a very important question, how do you know if they're going to change? And that's the third element to it, is having the accountability and the evaluation frameworks that are strong and clear. And where blackfellas in that community judge whether that organisation is becoming more culturally safe or not. Not self-assessment and not self sort of, you know, bull ticking boxes and nice little graphs. So we set up a system where Aboriginal community can talk to them in strong ways, good ways, tell them when they need it. But lastly, the most important element of all of it is the human element. Because we work with big organisations, right, and small organisations, and blackfellas too. Some of our black organisations need this. They're still confused on cultural safety, or they got whitefellas who, good ways, got Western skills but nothing Aboriginal. Or some of our own Aboriginal mob are confused on what which way to go, and they, you know, tearing each other apart, lateral violence too. So we work with Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal organisations to get really clear about what is cultural safety? What do they want it to mean for them? What will work and won't work? And, you know, what they're ready for. You can't push anyone, but we work with any organisation or community to help them step that stuff out slowly and sensibly, but map it out so there's change over time. But unless the fourth element, that human element, is taken care of, meaning holding each other, we ABSTAR stands for Aboriginal Straight Talking About Responsibility and Respect.
I didn't know
so
that.
So we talk straight talking, straight talking with love, and not just talking, doing, straight talking with love. So it's setting up the right spaces for blackfellas to unlearn lateral violence and start looking after each other a bit more, and safe spaces for white people to unlearn their whiteness and start having them light bulb moments and challenging themselves and taking responsibility, not feeling too scared to have a go, but on the other hand, don't do nothing unless you, you know, being led by blackfella voices and stuff. So all them little subtle but very important issues that most organisations are confused on, we step that out for them, and coaching, support, because you can have all these things written deadly in a document, but unless it's the human element of working with each other and learning those relationships, and that's what Aunty Lil and Aunty Mary say, establishing the relationship lessens the potential for conflict. Where there's conflict, that between black and white, or between black and black, or between white and white, that's a good example of not good Aboriginal governance or good Aboriginal terms of reference. So all of these elements have to come into helping the learner, black and white, and multicultural mob, learn, unlearn, learn, unlearn, learn, unlearn.
Yeah, it's a great approach, you know, and it is unfortunately a unique approach. You know, you look at this space in terms of, not this space, but the cultural awareness space and the tick box exercises that go with it. And, you know, the first point of call is always, oh, we've got to teach people our culture, where this exotic knowledge system that needs to be learnt, or, you know, or we become a problem that needs to be fixed, whereas this is a lot more sophisticated and a lot more, just ingrained in a lot of knowledge and depth. And it's and I've seen it, you know, work in action slightly through my days in Youth Justice. Unfortunately, they never pressed on with it, and they're probably wondering why they're still in the same position. But anyway, that's a time for another yarn.
Look, there's lots of people out there saying they're doing cultural safety or cultural awareness or cultural capability, whatever you call it. And that's all good. I support all Aboriginal mobs. But unless there's a very clear and concise view on whose responsibility is change and what accountabilities are necessary and where is the money going, where is the power, who's making the decisions, unless you tie all of these things into a strategic change model and help mobs see their progress over time, measure it over time, then we're going to be having the same yarns, unfortunately, in 20 years. But anyway, there's lots of good mob taking up the work, so that's good.
And this sort of change that we're talking about, it, as you said, it's, you know, a constant, ever-flowing, infinite game, really, you know, of this unlearning, learning, unlearning, and it doesn't happen. None of this change happens overnight. And some of the mob, I can imagine, you know, that you are working from ground zero. And how do you sort of, you know, probably can be a bit emotionally, spiritually and physically taxing, I can imagine. How do you manage that sort of things to maintain the energy and the efforts in working with mob that, you know, might be four or five steps behind where they need to be?
Yeah, great question. Two things. Firstly, our team constantly debrief and support each other and yarn about this and that and have a good swear if we need to about that one hard head in that one meeting or whatever. You know, you got to debrief and talk to each other. Secondly, we support our staff to have time, you know, to go into community or have time off or spend time with family as they need it, because that's all critical. But thirdly, the most important thing is we don't take clients on if they only want bullshit. So having that very clear line in the sand up front, we're not trying to convince no one, put it that way. I'm not trying to convince no government department or university or school or corporation or community org. I'm not trying to convince no one that this is necessary, because you waste a lot of energy in that. If they want it, they will come and ask for it, and then we can work with them on where they're at. But we're not going to pretend that all of these organisations who've got wraps or got the flags hanging out the front are actually serious about change. So we assess them up front. They come and reckon they're interviewing us, but we interview them. Are they really ready or not?
Yeah, no, that's good. Yeah, it is, because it, I suppose, changes the dynamic in terms of even just business generally. You know, it's this constant capitalist mentality of supply and demand and trying to pitch and sell, whereas, as you said, you can, I can imagine you would conserve a lot of energy and a lot of... Yeah, it would help a lot, I think, making sure that you are working with the right people, with the right intent, with the right leadership, from the outset.
And this is the thing, the tie over with business is, you know, we sometimes are so keen to get our culture and knowledges valued and recognised. We don't mean it, but sometimes we give it away for free or for cheap or for nothing. And these white organisations expect it. Oh, can you be on this advisory committee or that cultural group or this RAP working group or whatever? And my answer is always no. If you are serious, you will form a decision-making group with our local Aboriginal communities. And those Aboriginal groups will make decisions about budgets with that organisation together then. So, again, it's a good, like, it's more likely to produce better results, you know. It's more strategic, not operational or not sort of advisory. But it's also just being real, it's also much better for business. And you make them pay for your advice. If you're going to give advice, make them pay for it. Don't give it away for free or peanuts. And anyone who don't want to pay for your advice, they're not worth, they're not serious, in my view.
Yeah. No, you bring up a lot of good points there. And on that business side of things, I mean, ultimately, the current climate that this country is built on is one of, capitalist neoliberal foundations, which is very much in opposition to our philosophy as blackfellas. As a black business, how do we turn the dial on that across the board? I know you've said you've done it in certain realms, but how do we shift the tides of a capitalist neoliberal foundations of a country?
Well, at least two parts of that. The first part is many blackfellas go into business thinking about it's all about making money and being like white business people. Mm. Yeah? You know, profit, money. That's not the point, in my view. You can be a for-purpose and for-profit business, meaning you can make money, fine, to be independent. We're not here just to make a gazillion dollars. We're here to feed ourselves and pay deadly black employees to do more deadly work, and that's more than enough for us. But the main point is not the dollar value. The main point is what impact are you having in communities? Are you serious? See, even there's some Aboriginal consulting organisations or Aboriginal businesses out there. Good luck to them. Whatever, they do their own thing, that's all right. Not quite how I would work. Some of them just go for that contract, don't care about the content, just get the money. That's not really the way we work. We don't take any contract just because it comes through the door. We be very clear about, is it values aligned? Is the community going to get any benefit out of this? And then you can worry about, you know, making sure your costs are covered and all of those sorts of things. So for us, business is just a model to be independent. Mm. I spent 20 years working in government departments and in universities, mostly 15 years in universities. I bashed my head against a brick wall, telling them all how to change, and they don't want to listen. Mm. And so that's why I got out and became independent. I don't particularly like the term or the white business model, but it is a vehicle for me to be independent, for us to shake it up and change the system independently. Because then they can't say, oh, your funding's been taken or this or that, or, you know, try to disemploy you. We're telling those universities and government departments and corporations all the same things we told them for them 20 years bashing their head against the wall. We're telling them the same things, and now they're listening. Mm. And now they pay you double. Silly buggers.
Yeah.
So any of you blackfellas out there bashing your head up against the wall in a big bureaucracy, white bureaucracy, good luck to you. Make sure you've got good Aboriginal bosses or non-Aboriginal bosses who will protect you. If you don't, and it's a colonial system, and if you're not supported to be a full blackfellow in your job, I would highly recommend you look elsewhere, because those big systems will eat your soul, and they do it time and time again. And I know it's hard, because sometimes we think, no, stay in here, we get this next bit of change for our mob and all that. But ultimately, when you reach that fork in the road, don't stay there, because that's about valuing yourself. You have much more skills, and other people will employ you who are ready for your skills. Get out and be independent, or work with your own mobs, or work with whoever it is that you feel culturally safe and valued at work.
Yeah,
that's why I got out, and that's why business is just a vehicle.
Yeah,
I'm not here to make money, I'm here to make impact, and if it happens to be through this model, fine.
Yeah, I think a lot of our own mob too can take that advice, in terms of, you know, there's seen to be so much opportunity in the Indigenous procurement policies and all these other different things, and I think the real risk is that, you know, we become black and brown people in these institutions, and just repeat what is already existing, and don't, you know, instill our cultural knowledge and our cultural value systems in place. And that independence piece, I think, you know, was probably the thing when I walked through the doors here that was so refreshing, you know, to know that. And you know it, like, you know, when you walk through a place, because I think, you know, being at that fork in the road, working for a non-Indigenous institution that should be an Indigenous institution, or in the Indigenous space, you come at a fork in the road, as you said. You've got to either walk away, or you've got to accept that that's what it is. And the acceptance part can be all-consuming, and it's not good for anything. So I think that independence piece is such a powerful piece of guidance and advice that you sort of spoke about there.
Yeah, and self-care is a radical act. self-care and valuing one's own self properly is a radical act, because these systems want us to think that we're poor little black fellows, got nothing to offer except our culture, and they want us to give them our culture for free or cultural advice, but then ignore it when they don't like that advice. So what I'm saying to our mobs is get clearer about who's really being valued.
And we've spoken a lot about transformational change and systems change and all those sorts of things. I mean, they're really long-term indicators, you know. And so I want to transport you in time to 50 years from now and thinking about all of the work that you do in this space. And in an ideal world, it's 2073. What does, not so much Indigenous business, but what does the climate of this country look like for our people?
Well, people think transformational change and decolonisation are big, massive things that might take lifetimes to happen. And they are and they aren't. My view of decolonisation is it's like colonisation is a process. It's not an event. It didn't just happen and then ended in 1788. Colonisation is today, right? It's an ongoing process. So just like colonisation is a process, so too is decolonisation. Decolonisation is not one event or one strategy or one fix or one election change or one blackfella at the top of the tree or none of that. That's all, you know, nice. But decolonisation is a process. And so you could say, well, oh, it's too long a process. I don't know how to get there. So, you know, we just work on incremental change right here in front of us. In my view, that's giving up. Yes, incremental change is important, but what we actually have to do is have a very clear view on how to decolonize over time, what the steps are, what the processes are, how do you measure it? And then you can bite off this chunk and then bite off that chunk and then go and do that bit. So it's not incrementalism that's blind. It's starting the ball rolling now in the things that matter. And the most important things that matter is, as Arnie Lilla and Arnie Mary say, changing the mindset and coming back to Aboriginal terms of reference. That's the most critical change any person or individual organisation can make. And if you think you know what Aboriginal terms of reference are, I would challenge you to go back and learn again. Go back to those two elders or Black Card Training or someone who can teach you that, because it's not anything I learnt. Even in my deadly black grounded family growing up, and it's not anything I learnt at high school or wherever, it's something I learnt off those two elders. So once you know that stuff, and I'll give you a positive example. Actually, organisational change doesn't have to take forever. Strategic reform. So one of the examples we use is a mainstream example is the Australian Defence Force. When they had a problem with sexual violence against women, well, they've had that for forever. But about 8 years ago, young men in the Defence Force were caught filming young women having sex. And so this big crisis finally boiled over into the media, despite the fact women in the Defence Force have been asking for that change for a long time. Now, there were a few instructive things that happened. Firstly, the head of the army at the time, David Morrison, I think his name was, he did a few things that are very instructive. Firstly, he listened and believed. He did not treat it as a PR problem. Secondly, he took strategic advice from senior women leaders inside and outside the organisation. Thirdly, he called the behaviour out publicly and set a line in the sand and said, no more. If you do it again, you're out. Fourthly, he put in place more culturally safe or gender-safe reporting mechanisms so that women who were being abused could talk to other women rather than to the corporal or the sergeant who most often committed the abuse. So independent assessment and reporting of the complaint. Then he put in place amelioration or remedial things for, you know, what to do about it for both the victim and the perpetrator. Lastly, he set in place a very clear reporting annual accountability mechanism so that this was reported on publicly annually. Now, that doesn't mean that the Australian Defence Force is perfect now, or that there is no more sexism in the Defence Force. What it does mean is there's some very sensible steps that can be taken to turn the ship around, and that only took about 2 years. So we use that example all the time with some of our organisations in relation to Aboriginal stuff. If you have a serious leadership team and board and the right resources and the right accountability mechanisms, you can make massive change, but you have to be serious about knowing why and what to do.
Yeah, it's a good example. And just in wrapping up, I am mindful of your time, Greg, and I've been sitting on the sidelines watching Abstar grow from strength to strength, and a good friend of mine recently joined the team. What's on the horizon for Abstar in 2023?
Well, for us, we have to strengthen our online training models. We have to grow our team because we've got too much work coming in the door. We've got to strengthen our accreditation model. We want to develop our evaluation model to a point where we can start accrediting these white organisations for how culturally safe they are over time, because we're very clear that RAPs don't know what they're talking about, bless their hearts. And so, yeah, there's a few R&D things, research and development things in the works. We have plenty of work. But at the moment, top of my list is I got to do a performance review and how do we on properly. I've got to get little background forms and processes going yet, but Murray don't know how to run a business properly. I'm just learning. So we got a few little things in the background we got to work on. But the most critical thing for any Aboriginal business is to keep a very clear view on what your values are. How do you know they're culturally grounded? Who keeps you to account, even if you're in business? So we have an elders knowledge group who help keep us to account. And yeah, so we don't want to grow too big too soon. We don't have to be the biggest and baddest. We just want to make sure we do good quality work. But to your question about 50 years from now, what I want to see, my vision, is that we have a republic that is Aboriginal based on, you know, dual sovereignty. So Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people can share, but Aboriginal place in the political system is established and guaranteed, not this gammon constitutional voice rubbish, advisory voice stuff. Look, nice to have, but not substantive in my view. So I want to see that big picture structural reform. I want to see every one of our young Aboriginal people knowing and learning what Aboriginal terms of reference and culture and values are, regardless of what family they grow up in. I want to see Aboriginal people trading, running our own local governments, our own mobs, and running our own international governance based on our own way of doing things. I want to see a national alliance of all local Aboriginal mobs so we can be joined up but different. And, you know, we should be in not too many years' time like our old people, which is trading directly with China or South America on our terms, or trading directly with, you know, any other country. And we should be independently represented at the United Nations. So these are the things that I think are very within our reach. But we have to do the work now of planning ourselves what our own government looks like based on Aboriginal cultural law and laws. And then we can do the work of how do we make agreements or interact with white governments and the rest of the world. And it's very close. We just have to dream big. At the moment, we're dreaming a bit small, talking about advisory committees.
Yeah, it's a good point you make there in terms of, you know, redesigning and reimagining a model and a system based on our terms of reference. And I hope she doesn't mind me mentioning this, but I sat with Aunty Lilla only a week or two ago, and I asked her around what her thoughts were on this voice to parliament thing that's in hot topic at the moment. And she didn't say yes or no to anything, but gave this really response that was just full of wisdom around, well, we're always put in a position to respond to something, And that's what this is. It's a response to. It's not all of those things that you had just mentioned about reimagining a model and a system based on our terms. It was just we're always forced into a position to respond to whatever's on the table. And yeah, so that was I think that's a really nice way of summing it up and putting the future, you know, the future stuff into perspective too.
Because these white systems were begging to give us a little bit of voice or a little bit of money or a little bit of this or that. These white systems are crazy. They don't know how to manage the country. There might be nice people in there, might be nice black fellas in there and nice white fellas, but the system is crazy. They don't know how to manage the country. And if we keep following their system, we're going to become crazy too. We have to come back to our own way and our own systems, and then we can negotiate, not consult, not advise. Then we negotiate with white fellas on our terms how we will interact with them and not interact with them. And for those of you mob, some people think, oh, that's just separatist. That's true, you know, we can't survive without that white system and whatever. Well, it's not separatism. It's practicalities. There's enough evidence before us that the white system doesn't work. Hello, it doesn't work for white people. So they're not going to work for us. So let's look at the evidence and start coming back to our own ways of doing things and believe in ourselves a bit more.
Yep. There's a longitudinal study there that expands over 60,000, 80,000 years of a well-functioning system. Yeah, no,
that's right.
Thank you very much. I want to thank you very much for coming on the program today, Greg. And I thank you and your team and all the other mob in the space that you work in, the tireless work to, you know, really reshape the narrative of this country. So I just want to thank you for your time.
No, you're deadly, bro. Thank you, AAA. Love your work.
No, thanks, Greg. And you have been listening to Let's Talk. If you want to hear more from today or catch another episode of Let's Talk, just head on over to AAA.org.au. Thank you for your company.
No more whispering in our mind. Let's Talk, Monday to Friday at 9 a.m. on AAA Murray Country, the National Indigenous Radio Service and iHeartRadio. You can catch up on AAA.org.au, proudly supported by the Community Broadcast Foundation.